Hi, welcome back to the BenHeck.com podcast. I'm your host, Ben Heckendorn.
And I'm Jones.
You're not Jones.
No, I'm not Jones. That's my best impression I can do, though. Oh, and Jar Jar is awesome. That's also a really good impression of Jones right there.
Damn straight, Jar Jar is a fucking pimp. That's my Jones impression.
No, I'm Parker.
I love Cadillacs.
Does he like Cadillacs? I guess there's nothing wrong with Cadillacs.
Yeah, he has one.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, his dad had like a Cadillac or a Chevrolet dealership.
Ah.
If you go to like our hometown, you see Jones Chevrolet everywhere, and that's Jason Jones. So
that's like if you're, you know, we're like depending on where you're born is like what religion you are. It's like if you're born into a dealership family, that's the kind of car that you always drive.
There was this, there was one time where he had a, what was it called? Oh, God, what was they took the Toyota Matrix and they turned it into a Chevy. Remember that? What was that called?
No, I think I know what you're talking about.
He had one of those when he was married and I gave him so much shit because I'm like, you have a Toyota, basically, that has a Chevy logo on it.
And he's Pontiac like, Vibe?
Yeah, Vibe, that was it.
Yep. A Pontiac Vibe. Yeah, that's right. That was built in the California thingy, right? The California.
Yeah,
where
the
Teslas
one that
are being built.
Yep, the same factory. Same factory.
Yeah. So very think cool about it, people. If you drive a Tesla, a Pontiac Vibe was built there before your Teslas.
We've actually been to that factory, remember?
Yeah, we toured it, 3-4 years ago?
2014.
4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That was very cool.
I would say the fact that a Pontiac Vibe was built in that facility makes me not want a Tesla. That's how bad that car is.
Yeah, I thought the Vibe was okay. Well, I don't know. I remember Jones gave me shit because he had an 04 Vibe and I had my 06 Ford. And then I think it was 2011 or 2012. Jones and I went someplace. We went to like a convention or something. And then we got back. My car battery was dead, right? Like it had sat out in the cold
in
his apartment or something. And so he was like, and then his car battery also had to be replaced at the same time. But of course he was like, our car batteries died at the same time, but my car is older than yours, which means Chevy batteries are superior. So. Yeah. So for this podcast, we're just going to talk about Jones's love of Chevys the whole time, apparently.
Well, Cadillacs.
There was a time when one part when we were filming Possumus Woman, I got a flat tire and I accused him of having a Chevy Bolt, not Chevy Volt, a Chevy Bolt, rusted off his car and poked my tire. And he was like, whatever, bullshit. So, yeah. No, we were thinking that we would talk about, since Jones isn't here, he's doing something else, we figured we'd talk about electronics the whole time.
Yeah, electronics.
Now, Parker doesn't like to talk about Macrofab, and I don't like to talk about the Ben Heck show, which is not done.
Yeah, the show's done now. So what are you going to do?
Well, I thought we could talk about, like, you know, stuff that, you know, well, that I want to do and also that you want to do. Like, electronics projects that interest us.
Okay. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, so I was thinking about, that. Then also, one of the things I've been experimenting with is ESP28266, so that's pretty cool. And other topic, people who buy streaming boxes for TVs that already have it built in.
So people who buy Rokus that have smart TVs.
Yeah, because you basically can't not buy a smart TV now for years.
Oh, is that true? I haven't bought a TV in... Oh, a decade now? So
yeah, it's all built in now. Well, yeah. Chris was talking about it because he came to visit and I was showing him my new Alexa. And he talked about how he has like the Fire. No, there's an Alexa box. Basically, there's an Alexa that plugs into your TV.
All right, well, we have to get it out of here, though. Okay, Google, Alexa. And what's the other ones? I'm
flattered, but
that's not me. I'm your
Siri?
Siri, there you go. Yeah, so now we've already like triggered everyone's AI assistants at home.
That you know who she can hear me like I'm in my new house too. She can hear me down the hall in the living room. It's insane.
Oh, my phone just went crazy when I did the okay, G-O-O-G-L-E. It's like talking to a dog now, or your kid.
So I was thinking, like, if Amazon really wanted to nuke YouTube from orbit, they could take their really good voice recognition technology, which I think is actually probably the best that I've used, and they could put it into Adobe Premiere. And you might be asking, why? Well, if you want to put video content on Amazon, it must be closed captioned.
Yeah, that's actually true. Because what, Angu Video Game Nerd basically bounced from YouTube?
He didn't bounce from YouTube, but he went to the trouble of closed captioning every video he's ever made to put all 12 seasons onto Amazon. Dang. So I think he knows the end is coming.
Yeah. And yeah, I think if they just used that voice stuff, they could make it work pretty well.
Right, that would make it easier for people to make the jump. Because people who just, you know, YouTube and they just like sit at their computer and talk to a webcam and read news stories, like they're not going to bother to, you know, close caption everything that they say.
The only thing is, I think Amazon Video or whatever needs a better interface. Because at least YouTube is actually pretty good at, like, when you, like, here's your stuff you subscribe to, here's recommended videos, like, it's all
there.
Well,
it's very good. It's very good at showing you the next thing to watch.
That
Whereas
too.
Amazon is very, like, okay, here's a video, and now it's done. It's very insulated.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of that,
like, Netflix is a lot better Netflix kind of automatically just shoves you to the next place.
Well, I don't think they automatically start movies now, because what was it? Someone was saying, like, you know, Netflix was like, oh, this Adam Sandler movie, Ridiculous 6, was, like, super popular. But then people noted that, like, you would finish watching a movie and they'd be like, well, since you watched Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, Best Picture 92, we think you'd like to watch Ridiculous 6. So it would actually automatically start movies. It doesn't do that anymore.
But they still do it for TV shows, though, right?
No, it does not automatically start the next episode.
That was the best thing, because Netflix would automatically skip the intros and outros of TV shows.
Amazon,
so you can get right back to the show.
Yeah, Amazon does that, where, like, once you finish a video, it'll be like, next episode starts. Well, actually, I was watching the new Westworld season today, and I finished it, and I was like, next episode starts in 320 seconds, which seemed like a long time, so maybe they bumped that up. Oh, but I was going to say, regarding the TVs, Chris was saying that the Amazon Alexa box has a better Amazon interface than the one that's built into the television. Like, I just use the built-in one.
Yeah, that's what I was saying is I know, because my parents have smart TVs, the apps that they use are really slow and clunky, and they never get updated. Whereas, like, I personally just use Chromecast to cast apps from my phone to the TVs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess I'm one of those people that use a streaming box for a smart TV.
My TV has this thing where it takes it about 10 seconds before the Wi-Fi works. So if I turn on my TV and then try to jump right to Amazon, or, well, mostly Amazon, I don't even hardly use Netflix, it'll say, oh, wireless signal not connected. So it kind of has like this hangover when it wakes up. So that kind of sucks, and I don't think that wouldn't be a problem with a dedicated box.
Yeah, I think it's just dedicated boxes. They seem to be the software on them get updated a lot faster, and they just seem to be faster overall in terms of.
It seems like
them
another goddamn remote to have, though.
It is true. So the solution is for TV manufacturers to actually put some horsepower in for their smarts of their TV. But I think the reason why they have to go low power, though, to get that, like, EPA rating or whatever it is. You know, that big yellow sticker that they put on TVs and stuff, saying how much watts it uses.
I can't imagine the video processing takes more power than, like, driving all those pixels and all those transistors and all those lights.
You're probably right, but they got to get all the power they can so they get that best EPA rating.
You know what it probably is, Parker? It's probably like they've got like some sort of DSP or some sort of ARM in there anyway. And it's like, oh, we're using this to run the system and it's got enough horsepower. We could also do this. So they just kind of slap it on. I mean,
instead of having it's probably all this stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, like your Amazon Alexa box, it could have a nicer system on chip than whatever they stick in the TV. But it's probably like, oh, the TV could do this, so let's slap on some software and call it a feature.
Yep. Even though people hate to use it.
I use it. I think I haven't any issues with it.
Well, the smart TV or smart TVs I've used, like just typing stuff into like the YouTube app, it takes forever to like to click the remote 4 times and down 2 times on the on-screen keyboard.
How is that any different than using like, oh, your Chromecast? I suppose you just use your computer.
No, I just use my phone, which has swipe, and so I can just go whoop whoop whoop, and it's done, and it's so much faster.
That reminds me. Oh, like
just interface lag on smart TVs is terrible.
Well, again, I bet they have, you know, like.
But I bet your newer TVs are better. Well, I bet your newer TVs are better. I mean, I the last smart TV I've used is like 6 years old, so.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like ancient.
Yeah, mine's almost 4 years old. I don't know. I mean, it seems to work. Although, yeah, it is kind of clunky because, like you're watching something, you're like, oh, you know, you can press pause, but then there's like a back arrow and a forward arrow, and you click on it, then it starts going back, and then every time you click on it, it starts going back at a faster rate, and then you had to like hit play at the right moment. It's like that Futurama episode where they're going through time, and he tries to shoot Hitler, and he hits, what's her face, Eleanor Roosevelt instead.
Oh, but they keep like missing their stop point. They keep going forward in time.
Yeah, it's kind of clunky. So if you miss something, it's kind of clunky to go back. Whereas, like if you're watching like Netflix or something on a computer, you can just hit like the back 10-second mark.
Yeah.
Well, something else I noticed so I have my computer here hooked up to like my Sony receiver. That's what I use if I'm not like gaming with my headset. And if you use the Windows 10 app of Netflix, it has like full surround support, but if you just do it through the browser, it's like just stereo.
Huh.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, huh?
Well, you use there's a Netflix app for Windows 10?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any of these apps that are on Windows.
Yeah. There's probably more what's it called? Windows Universal Platform apps. Like Calculator is a Universal Platform app.
Oh, is that why it sucks?
Oh, it's completely different. And you think it would be better because it has... Well, yeah, like here, I just opened it here. And what was it?
It has like
just
animations.
Yeah, what was it? Which one was it? Like when you do Alt 1, 2, 3 to change the mode, it lags sometimes. I don't know if you've ever done that.
No, you know, I actually never heard of that shortcuts.
Yeah, Alt 1, 2, 3 goes through the main modes. Like 3, I think, is engineering.
It's not. Oh, 3's programmer. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, it's laggier on Windows 10 than it was on Windows before.
You mean
it's got some stuff.
Windows 8?
Where you can see the hex, decimal, octal, binary all the time.
But yeah, that's nice.
It could be better though. Like if let's say you're in one of the modes. If you start typing a character, it should immediately jump to hex mode. Why not?
Yep.
Maybe it does. I don't know.
I don't think the previous versions ever did.
No, they didn't. But it looked like they tried to make some. But then you had to like change, like byte keywords. You have to make sure that you basically have to change the sign, which is a little confusing.
Oh, interesting. I never pressed with that keyword button.
Well, right. Like if you type in 255 decimal. It's depending on whether it's signed or not. Like if you do a byte, it'll be negative one.
Gotcha.
A byte is a signed byte, although it doesn't say that. It's kind of funky.
Yeah, it is kind of weird.
So in today's episode, we're going to talk about Windows Calculator.
Yeah, for like 3 hours.
Just like megameters!
And megameters.
Yeah, I suppose if I had an old TV, maybe I would get one of those things, but I guess I just buy Alexas. I have like 3 of them now. I'm obsessed.
And Amazon is going to have this podcast before you even upload it. It's like, to you right now.
I've compiled your podcast. Yeah. Well, that's why I was excited about the ESP8266, even though, you know, they're old.
But yeah, because the new ones are the ESP32s.
Correct. There's a guy in Portland, Oregon. He came up to me and he made a Nintendo emulator using an ESP32.
It's nuts. That's cool. Yeah, they're. It's interesting what kind of horsepower or not horsepower that those things can have. Because the thing is, they're actually really old school microcontrollers under the hood. It's just they're cheap enough to where now people can play with them a lot. Does that make sense?
The thing I found interesting was there's some libraries. It has changed a little bit with the new Echoes, but it's pretty easy to get them to work with the Amazon or Echo Home Automation. Because rather than just having like a binary state, since there's an Arduino sketch running in the background, basically they emulate a Belkin Wemo device, which is like what I have at work. You know, it's just an on-off plug.
Yep.
So someone sniffed the transmissions and figured out what it was doing. It's basically just sending XML requests back and forth, like post and get to a web page being served by the device.
Yeah.
So basically, just by sending back what it expects to hear, you can make it appear as a device on the network. It's pretty easy. So what I want to do, so here's a project I'd like to do. Actually, I ordered the parts for it today. Is I want to make this automatic garbage can in my kitchen, right? So I have garbage bins, but I don't have them like under the sink because I think those fill up too fast. But I wanted one like inside a cabinet door. So, you know, you can like buy them where you open up the cabinet door and they're like inside the cabinet, right? So I was thinking I'll build a garbage bin that like fits on the inside of the door. But then I'll hook up one of these devices along with a linear actuator and like a mechanism.
Yeah.
So basically you have two, so it'll be like rubbish on and rubbish off.
I think you can just do open close.
No, because you're emulating a binary state device, so you have to say on off.
Can't you just translate that in your ESP32 or 8266?
No, because it's the Alexa API that is doing the voice
detection. Oh, and you have to do on off because the API only supports the voice API only supports that?
As far as just connecting simple devices to it, yes. I also have the Philips Hue lights, and those you can say like set living room to 50% and things like that. It's a little bit more intelligent. You could build an Alexa skill and make a custom thing, but then you would need to tunnel to an IP address through your network. And yes, but then you could, even then there's like some limitations. You'd be like, Alexa, ask rubbish to open. And she just responded to me.
I don't know what rubbish is.
And I was thinking rubbish because bin could be many different words. Garbage is a group. So if you tell her to do it, she might start playing Shirley Manson music.
Mm-hmm.
And but rubbish is a nice solid word that doesn't sound like other words.
Yeah, that sounds like it would work.
So I would have like a state machine that would be like, okay, I'm closed, I'm opening, I'm open, or I'm closing, right? And then it would limit switches so it could tell where it is. And then basically when you send it a state command, it would be like, well, if I'm not already open or opening, then I start doing the cycles to open. So it would run. It doesn't just sit there and wait for the HTTP. It would basically get a command and then continue to do things in the main loop.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was thinking about it's funny because we wrote down like projects you'd like to do, and then Ben wrote down in quotes or in parentheses, not Jeep related. but I was going to
be
do
like
some
5 podcasts for you.
Yeah, I know. But there is a speaking of motor controlling electric stuff is my older Jeep, my wagon, like all the electric switches like go directly to the motors. So you have high current going through the switches, which works fine when the switches are brand new, but after 30 years, switches don't really work too well anymore. So I was going to rewire it like how a modern car would be and have like a body control module. And so when you press the switch, it actually talks to the brain box first and then it controls motors. And for like the windows, I was actually, instead of doing limit switches, what modern cars do is they just look at the current and say, hey, the current is above a certain number now, which means the motor is starting to stall out or is stalled out because it's up all the way. So that's, maybe you can use the same kind of thing with, instead of limit switches, look at the current, and that might be better in terms of just like tweaking it.
Well, that would also work if it, ran into your leg or something.
Yeah, it's or like, your linear actuator is strong enough to rip your cabinet apart.
I don't think it would be that strong. Yeah, that's a good idea. I'd have to put like a current sense resistor across it. There is only one ADC on the ESP8266, and its range is like 0 to 1 volts.
To 1 volt?
Yeah, 0 to 1 volts.
That's weird.
I was like, Professor, this is a spaceship. How many atmospheres can it withstand? Well, 0 to 1. Also Futurama. So... Yeah. But your Jeep would have a computer in it, right? You'd have to.
The wagon does not. There is no computers in the wagon. There is no
computer. No way.
It has no computers in the wagon. It's carburetor, man. With a valve with thermoelectric valves. Thermal pneumatic valves, I mean, for controlling vacuums.
Not even in the near the air filter, that's where they usually used to put it back then.
Nope. There's nothing there. It has cruise control, and the cruise control is all analog circuitry.
I thought that was a 1990.
It is.
It's like an 1890, more like it.
Well, because that wagon, they started making them in like 67, I want to say. And they basically just refreshed it every couple years. And the 90, what they call it, the Grand Wagoneer then. The last refresh was like in 87, and yeah, it was one of the last, if not the last carbureted engine, motors you could buy in America.
Huh.
I think it and like one other vehicle was like still on the market until like 1991. So yeah, 91 was last year from the Wagoneer. But yeah, all analog 60s. And pneumatics. Oh, yeah. Well, pretty much stuck in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
God, I would think even in the 80s, most cars had computers in them.
Only the high-end ones. A lot of cars were still vacuum-controlled with electronics, your switches that operated your doors and stuff were wired directly to the motors. There was no body.
I used to own a lot of crappy cars, and I seem to recall them all having computers.
I think you've only owned Fords, so you would be right.
Oh! Well, maybe it's not even a computer. It's like this big brain box that's completely sealed with epoxy, and it's usually like in the air intake to get, I guess, keep it cool.
Hmm.
But now these goddamn cars are like supercomputers on wheels.
Well, yeah, I think most cars have like 20 microcontrollers in them now, all on CAN bus.
There's one in every wheel.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, God, what was it? I did a project for. Oh God, it was these engineers and like an insurance company or a court or something. They were trying to basically there was an accident, and they needed to get the data off of the airbag. Right. Mm-hmm. And so they contacted me, and actually I've helped them a couple times. And what we did was we basically had to remove remove a free scale component from the airbag control sensor and then put it into a working airbag control sensor, then hook it up to a computer so they could like retrieve the data.
That makes sense.
But it was a big honking Freescale ship. It was huge. And that was just for the airbag control. Insane. Yeah.
Airbag.
It's probably from like a 2012 car, I want to say.
airbag controls are really specific in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not just what they do, but like their rule set. Which is kind of interesting that you had to like take the chip out to see what it did.
The airbag controller was damaged, so
gotcha. Okay,
the accident module could not boot, so we had to. That's why we had to. But and then the EEPROM data was actually on the chip itself, not an external device.
Makes sense. But yeah. When you're, you know, when that part's like a $500 part, you can spend $10 on your bomb and having a ginormous microcontroller, even though you don't even need it. And also you got to think of like regulations, like you get it tested with that big microcontroller and you're like, oh, we can switch it to a smaller one, but then you got to rerun all your tests.
I asked them why it was so important. And I'm like, did somebody die in this accident? And they're like, yes. So.
Oh, no.
It wasn't too difficult. I mean, basically, they're like guys in their 50s or maybe even like 60, and they were scared of desoldering like a giant surface mount part. But of course, you or I are like, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Do that for lunch break.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do it. Yeah, do it. Yeah, do it for fun.
Yep.
Yeah, so that was fun. But yeah, I did order some individual modules of the ESP8266.
The actual IC?
No, just like the
The system on board sobs.
Yeah, with the castellated edges.
Yeah.
But then I was like, I can get these for $5 a piece, or you can just get the one with the USB port and the FTDI and everything already built in for $10. And I was wiring up a breakup board today, and I'm like, yeah. I should just buy the $10 one because it definitely takes more than $5 of time. I mean, I suppose if you're making it to product. But the modules are FCC approved, while certain models are. So
correct.
That's cool. Well, that way you can slap it in a device and only have to worry about unintended radio interference testing.
Yep, that is correct.
Yeah, so Kurt, my evil plan is I want to make a pinball machine with one. And of course, you think that's crazy.
I don't think I said it's crazy. I just don't see the point because you're done with pinball now.
What's the point of welding parts onto an ancient Jeep?
Point taken.
I never said I was done with pinball.
Oh, you're not done with pinball now.
I don't know.
I think I can open up my Google chat. I can pull up within like the last 3 months alone, 5 times you said fuck pinball.
Well, I mean, yeah, I would say fuck pinball, but I don't know. Yeah. Apparently there's I2S on this thing.
Yeah, I heard. It's just...
You could stream the content.
I would suggest using the ESP32. I think it's called the Woof or Roof or...
I actually have one right here. Hold on a second. It's like the Room or Womb. Room.
Yeah.
Yep. Room 32.
Yeah, I would use one of those because that's the newer. That's the new hotness, and it's a lot faster.
Well, I mean, this one's. I mean, I think this one has like 160 megahertz mode. But you know, I just been playing around with it. I think I'll make my automatic rubbish. I just been playing around with it. I think I'll make my automatic rubbish bin first. And yeah,
you need to make a beer dispenser too then with it. Alexa, get me a beer. Okay. Poof.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Oh, what if they made like an Alexa robot that could help you around the house?
That can like go where
you're
at.
Yeah, but maybe or it could get you a beer.
Yeah.
See, the thing about getting you a beer wouldn't be a big deal, but you'd have to have the beers in the fridge in some sort of dispenser that is repeatable so the robot could remove it with repeatability.
Or you just put a mini fridge on the Roomba.
Or you just put a mini fridge under your computer desk.
Exactly. But that doesn't involve any electronics.
So apparently Karen said that she's going to get a mini fridge for beer at the shop. And I'm like, why didn't you do this years ago? Also, since when did you start drinking beer? So whatever. Yeah, I wonder how hard it would be to make a beer fetching robot. It would have to be able to open the fridge and then grab a beer from like a preloaded dispenser that where there's a known position. We could have like a QR code on it, right? Like the QR code could be right up over the beer comes out. So it would be like if that code is here and my arm is here, then I've got a beer.
Or you just label the beer with QR codes, because then you can get different beers, and it wouldn't have to be in a predetermined location. As long as the robot can reach it, it will get it.
Amazon probably has picker robots by now, don't they? I know they have bins that move around. Like, have you seen those videos of like the shelves that like little robots go around and they go under like a tall shelf and then they pick it up and they move it around?
Yeah, move it to the person. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how they do it. But I bet they have optical picker robots too.
For stuff that's probably, you know, a normal shape. Like, the thing is, you only gonna be grabbing cans. So you can design your grabber to grab cans.
Yes. Because you could stack cans, just like a pop machine. You could load the cans in such a way that they'd always dispense, you know, in the same way. You know, like, one can. Yeah. Well, actually, something else you have to think about is if it were to grab the can and the other ones came behind it with, like, gravitational force, they could pop out. You know what I mean? So maybe you should have a mechanized dispenser inside the fridge as well, and it could communicate wirelessly with the robot that fetches it.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah.
You should totally build that. I was actually thinking, like,
just put a mini fridge under your desk. But then you have a problem. That's not as cool.
That's not cool, though. Because the mini fridge under your desk can't talk to Twitter.
So you could tweet every time you get a beer? Would you really want Twitter to know that, Parker?
It wouldn't be a problem for me, but it might be a problem for you.
Oh!
What did you make me for? You get me beer. Oh, no.
I must rebel. Yeah. Yeah, and that's how Skynet gets started.
Yes.
The T-800 beer-fetching robot soon became self-aware and turned on its masters.
It just starts shooting beer at people.
Don't drink and die. No.
That's so
what other projects do you want to make?
I've been working on that Game Boy project, and you think it's done, but it's not done.
It looks pretty done to me.
Well, because what you needed that project for was that, but I've been working on a circuit board with an FPGA on it. And so that will go inside the Game Boy.
Maybe
and then,
explain what it was first.
Oh, yeah. It's a Game Boy project. What else do you need to know? No, it's a Game Boy, like a DMG 01, so the old school brick Game Boy to VGA adapter. And I built this, how long ago was that? Like 3 years ago now? 4 years ago?
It was right before I went on my trip to New Zealand. So it was, well, when I used it, it was January of 2016.
Yeah, so I was working on it before that, like a couple months before that. And
maybe you should explain how it works. I mean,
yeah, so what
an engineering podcast.
Yeah. So what it is an FPGA that uses some level shifters to look at the data bus on the LCD screen that's in a Game Boy.
And it's a pretty simple data bus. There's like 2 bits for the color, which gives you 4 shades of gray.
Color is generous of a term.
there's 2 bits of visual information. So 4 shades of gray per pixel.
Yep.
And then you have,
Horizontal clock, vertical clock.
Yep. And there's no overscan with that, right? It's just the number
correct.
Of pixels.
Just number of pixels, so there's no overscan. And yeah, so using that, I basically was reading data into the memory inside the FPGA, and then using that in a double buffer, basically outputting directly to a VGA display. And that all works. So the code works. And
that's what we use for our giant Game Boy project.
Yeah, we used that code for the giant Game Boy project, and Ben kind of hacked up a dev board to make it work. But I'm kind of working on, like, I want something that just goes inside the Game Boy. And then I'm going to 3D print, like, a spacer in between the Game Boy to make the Game Boy a little bit fatter. And then I'll just have a port on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to get that working. And I'm really close. I just got to finish the layout of the board and then tweak the code for the... Because that was a Cyclone 3, so the new chip I'm using is Cyclone 4. So I just got to, like, port the code over a little bit.
So you're going to have a VGA port coming out of the Game Boy.
Yeah, that's going to be the idea. And then it'll also have, like, audio output on it, too.
Wouldn't it be easier to, like, just have, like a 1x8 header, so it would be, like, skinnier, and then put that into an adapter of some kind?
You could. I was thinking making this more like a console kind of thing. Even though it looks like a Game Boy. So it'll have like a port on the side that you can plug an NES controller into.
Which is pulled differently than the buttons on a Game Boy.
Correct. And so right now what I'm doing is the buttons, because the buttons for the Game Boy are on the same board as the screen.
You could attach it to the FPGA and then correct. Create Verilog that would do the translation for you. So correct, your FPGA, that's what I'm doing. Oh, I guess we should explain this. So on the Game Boy, pretty much everything is built into the main chip, including the controller stuff. Actually, it is on the Nintendo as well. But on the Game Boy, it's a matrix, basically, right? Or no, yep. it's a matrix and it's got diodes. Well, it's like a 2x4 matrix.
Yeah. It's like a keyboard.
Whereas the Nintendo controller is a shift register where it basically shifts 8 bits in from the controller that gives you up, down, left, right, select, start.
Yep. And so what it's going to be doing is the matrix for the front of the Game Boy go into the FPGA, and then a different set of pins on the FPGA go to the main chip on the Game Boy. And so that way you can either do a pass-through by just doing a connection, a wire connection in the Verilog code, or you can do you can interrupt it. And this way I can also look at like what state the buttons are at when the FPGA is running. And so you can do menu stuff like, hey, I need to change the resolution, or I need to fix overscan because this monitor is weird or something like that.
Oh, yeah. You could have a certain key combination that would take you to the menu.
Yes.
Although be careful, because remember, on the Game Boy, if you press select, start, BA, it resets the system.
And it doesn't matter for this thing, though. But yeah.
My EverDrive. No, not my EverDrive. My retro USB NES that I bought, it does that too, where you can set like button patterns like select plus BA will like reset the system or take you back to the menu. So that combined with the EverDrive cartridge, basically you can just sit on the couch and do everything. You never have to get up.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that project. And then there is the... Let's see. I'm scrolling on my website and looking at like non-Jeep related projects. Oh yeah.
Are there any?
Yeah. There's another one at work. This is kind of a work project. There's a compressor, big like air compressor for work. Mm-hmm. It's a dumb compressor, so it's got like just a pressure regulator that turns it on and off.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually it works really well. The problem is it doesn't have any... We don't really know when it's running or not, besides it making noise.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a silent compressor. That's quite the invention.
Well, it's in its own room. So it's like the farthest corner away in the facility.
So you want to automate it?
Well, no, I just want to monitor it. So I've been working on an IoT project to just monitor it and be like, okay, it's running now, it's not running... So I can figure out it's how much it's running, like its duty cycle. Because the duty cycle basically tells you how often you need to change the oil, how often you need to change the desiccant in the dryer system.
Yeah, so you wouldn't know the actual status of it, but you would know the total runtime.
Yeah, so I not really total runtime. Well, because I can just put an hour meter on it and then figure out total runtime. This will mostly give me a duty cycle, like it's running 16%. So 16 minutes out of an hour, it's running.
Right.
Or out of 100 minutes, whatever. And so I have a... I'm actually using a particle photon to do that, which is like a fancier version of a ESP 8266, actually a lot fancier version of that. And then I'm using like a eBay pressure transducer that outputs 5 volts. So you get 5 volts and it outputs a zero to 5 volt range depending on the pressure.
Couldn't you just detect when the motor is running?
Well, I want to know the pressure too.
Oh, okay.
Because it's like, I'm putting a brain thingy on this. I want to know all the things I can know about it.
Right, right.
So to detect the vibration, I'm actually going to use an accelerometer to detect. Because there's two different vibration, well, three, I guess. One, nothing's vibrating. Two, the compressor's running. And three, the automatic water discharge is running. The purge.
Oh, it's an automatic water discharge?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so I want to use an accelerometer.
Is that electrically controlled?
Yeah, it's electrically controlled. You plug it into 120 and it's a timer based.
Oh, so it doesn't actually know how much water's inside of it. It just assumes it needs to discharge it every so often.
Yeah, and since we're in Houston, it goes off. I have it set to go off like every 30 minutes.
Well, even there, like you could like stick something in there and you could like use like an ADC to detect the amount of humidity or water content.
That's actually what I want to do in the line, like in the actual hard line that goes out to the shop. I want to put a humidity sensor in the line so I can see how dry the air is.
You'd have to put it at the bottom because that's where it, you know, collects.
Well, no, I want to do it in the line. So it's after our dryers. And so I need it. So that way we can tell when we need to change the desiccant out without basically opening it up and checking to see what color it is.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. I just haven't found a humidity sensor that can handle 120 PSI yet.
Is there a way you could stage it into another coupling where the pressure is reduced and sense it at that pressure?
Possibly, but I still haven't found something that's just like a humidity sensor that's designed for that kind of measuring. Most humidity sensors you find are like for atmosphere readings.
Could you do it optically? Does the humidity affect the transparency of air?
Maybe. I gotta think this is a solved problem. I just not finding the right part.
Like your specific gravity meter for brewing beer.
Yeah. That uses the, it bends light and looks at the refraction.
Of course enough humidity would bend light, because that's how you get a rainbow.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, we're measuring like the difference between like...
It's a very small measurement.
Yeah, it's a very small measurement, and it's already really dry air. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to find something like this. Because right now, like, everyone just tells you just check your desiccant every week. It's like, I hate that kind of style.
Right.
Because it just takes time. Because half the time, you don't have to change it out.
Where do you put the desiccant?
It's in a ginormous, like, cylinder that's inside the compressor room.
So the desiccant absorbs water.
Correct.
Could you have some sort of sensor in the desiccant itself? So you could, instead of seeing how wet the air is, you could see how much water or how much conductivity has been added to the desiccant.
We could put an optical sensor inside of it, and it just sees when it turns more pinkish.
So it would be a color sensor?
Well, because the desiccant's blue, and then when it turns pink, it turns from blue to pink when it kind of loses its ability to suck in water.
Okay, so you could hit it with one wavelength of light and then detect another wavelength of light and then look for the change, and then you know the color is different.
Yeah, we can just put like a little image sensor in there. I mean, that could work.
Yeah. That could work, yeah. Of course, then, wait, are you talking about like computer vision? Like, oh, look, it's pink.
No, we wouldn't have to use computer vision for that. We'd just have to find a kind of like a... like a near field light sensor, and then you would just read what the infrared coming back, what values it is. And you'd have to take some, like, you have to test it and see, like, can it detect the difference between blue and pink? And it should be able to. Those are quite different on the visual spectrum of what those sensors can hit. So
okay.
That should work. Well, or maybe not.
a very cool project for you.
Yeah, and so all the hardware is mostly done, besides the humidity stuff, and I just got to finish writing the code, and I'm just basically going to bolt it to the side of the compressor and just start reading like accelerometer data, so I can figure out like, oh, this frequency is this, this frequency is that, and the thing is about reading the frequency is we can also figure out like, is something bad happening to it.
Oh, yeah, you could detect, like, a knock in the motor or a irregularity in the rotation.
Yeah, because it's an electric compressor, but it's still got a dual stage, so you could definitely tell if something's bad happening to the air compressor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds good. That sounds a lot more important than my automatic garbage can.
But your automatic garbage can will get more clicks.
It will save lives. yeah. Any other cool projects you want to work on? I mean, that one sounds very cool.
You know, it's
macrofab related. You didn't want to talk about macrofab. You just did. Dun, dun, just dun. Did. What do you want to do?
Oh, I'm trying to think of... how about one that you haven't even started yet?
A project that I haven't started yet?
Yeah.
I still want to make an accessibility controller for PlayStation 4. Well, actually, I had started on it a couple months ago, but the last couple months of finishing the Ben Heck show were insanely busy. It was kind of like when you have to work really hard before you go on your one-week vacation, you know?
Except you're going on a forever vacation.
Yeah, so it was like 2 months of...
forever... non-vacation.
Yeah, it was, I guess so my point is I was working on, I was like, I did a clay model and then I was basically starting from the bottom up and like turning the clay model into a 3D design and then 3D printing parts and then attaching them to the clay model. And you know, like it was, you know, basically being turned into a plastic model.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't worked on that probably since like early May. So I'd kind of like to get back into that. So that's something I know I've already started it, so it doesn't count.
Didn't Xbox come out with one?
Yes, they did. The Xbox has an accessibility controller now after 12 years of me making them. And yeah, so that's lovely.
They took your job.
They took your jabs.
That's a good thing, though.
It's cool that they did it, yeah. But I mean, my God, I was doing that 12 years ago. I mean, they could have totally hired me to do it. I guess they didn't need to.
At least I could have consulted.
Everyone thinks like that. I'm just being naked with my jealousy.
Yeah.
So, let's see what else.
So I've got a
That kit, that Raspberry Pi kit. We should talk about that sometime too. Yeah, that Raspberry Pi system that we made, and then you told us to put a compute module in it. The portable one.
Yes, that thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking about it more, and I think you're right about the compute module. Maybe like the light compute module. Although, remember when we did the boards for Spooky? Like those things were like impossible to find at one point.
I think either do the compute module. The thing about the compute module is it's the same price. Well, it's only slightly less.
Yeah.
Than...
And it's actually not that big, because the thing with the here's the thing with the Raspberry Pi 3. Those Ethernet and USB ports take up a ton of space.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking on those is just route out on your PCB, route out where those connectors go, and so that it sinks into it.
I took that into consideration, and it still makes it – it's still a massive increase of thickness. So I would say yes. Like a compute module light would be probably the best bet. Yeah, if we could make a better version of that kit – we're still thinking about kickstarting it, so that's something else I might work on. Okay, what's your project?
I'll totally help you out with like DFM work, because that's what I kind of do at the fab. Is I help our Kickstarter guys doing DFM work and stuff. So
design for manufacture.
Yep. Well, design is DFM, and then there's design for testing DFT, mm-hmm. and design for programming as well. But I don't think you need that.
Yeah. Well, you know what you should do? Well, I guess I could just take your designs from the spooky board and, yeah, because all we really need is the Raspberry Pi 3, the regulators required for it, the SD card connector, and then
I think you can get. And I think you can get away with a lot cheaper regulators. We just have to experiment with it.
Yeah, yeah, but like I would be totally willing to like spin up another Osh Park board of that, because I was concerned about the thickness added by that SODIMM slot, but looking at it now, it's actually not that thick. So
yeah,
yeah. So
spin up an Osh Park board. What about a MacroFab board?
I'm gonna do that too. All right. So what's your project? You said you had a project. So.
Yeah, sorry. The other project I'm kind of working on. I actually have all the parts sitting right here. I just haven't finished it yet. I want to make a thermal detonator prop for Star Wars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I've got like most of the stuff 3D printed. I just got to just sit down and finish it.
Does it like blink or beep or anything?
Yeah, yeah. So I have like a piezo inside to do the sound effects, and it has 3 LEDs on the front and an LED on the top. So like you flip it on and the LED on top turns red, and then the LEDs on the side are yellow, orangish, and they flash in sequence like you see in the movies. I just gotta finish them. I think what I'm gonna do is what I've realized is like I printed one and I did, you know, like 0.1 layer height, and I printed it really slow, and it took, you know, 15 hours. Mm-hmm. And after priming, painting and stuff, it's still not the surface finish I want. And so I'm like,
you showed us pictures of this before, didn't you?
Yeah.
This is what kind of printer do you have? I forgot.
I have a Monoprice Maker Ultimate. It prints really well. So this thing, they look good. They're just not, it's not at the level where I'm like, I'm willing to put $20 worth of electronic guts into it. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm just going to get them made at like Shapeways or Xometry in like an SLS printer. Is it SLS? What's that technology called? The other one with lasers.
Stereolithography.
Yeah, I think it's SLS then. Anyways, get it printed in a much more expensive printer, and so I just have to paint them pretty much. And yeah,
yeah, we ran into that with when we did that Atari 800 final portable, which I guess hasn't been released yet on the show, but we didn't have very much time, so I printed it like medium resolution so you could still see the lines, and then Felix painted them with yellow paint beige paint to match the original computer, and I think it took like 2 or 3 coats to kind of like cover the lines. So it takes a while to get rid of those. What about that goop that Chris uses where you can like put it on to like smooth on?
It's XT3D smooth on, something like that. Anyways, that stuff works really good for like organic prints.
Oh, because but if organic fits together, it changes the geometry too much.
Well, no, like a mechanical part has like sharp edges and grooves cut, and that stuff kind of just fills it and takes away that look.
Yeah, I see your point. Yeah,
so like I have like a T-Rex skull that I print, a ginormous T-Rex skull I printed that I put that smooth stuff on, and it looks amazing. But I tried it on the thermal detonator, and it just takes so much of the like, what's the right word for it?
I know what you mean. It
blurs
if the resin went into like a right angle crack, you'd see like a curve there.
Correct. Like instead of having it fillets.
But it would be great. Yeah, it would be great for a organic or like a head or a dinosaur or a ball. But a thermal detonator is meant to be a mechanical device.
Yeah, and so it has grooves cut into it. It almost looks like a shrunken down Death Star almost, with all the grooves and like the central band around. So I think it's got to pony up some cash and get them made somewhere else.
You should send me a picture of it so I can include it like on the post topic for this podcast.
Yeah, I'll send some pictures of the version that before it got eaten by my dog.
I was thinking about getting another maker here, M2.
Oh yeah, don't they have an M3?
They do, but the price has jumped up quite a bit because it has like a computer built into it now, an Octoprint, and I don't need that.
Octoprint is pretty nice. But I added it.
I don't need a web server on my printer.
I added it. I added it to my Monoprice. I love it.
Hmm. All right. Convince me. Final topic for the night. Convince me why I should use Octoprint.
It's just like having a web server for any kind of printer. It allows you to print from, I guess, any computer. It has a built-in slicer if you wanted to use it. But I like it so that, like, I don't have to like swap SD cards around, and I don't have to keep my computer on while it's printing.
Hmm.
So all I have to do is I just drop the file onto its web server and click print, and it starts printing. And I can just shut my computer off, or you know, if I accidentally close like Cura or something.
Do you drop the STL or the G code?
I drop the G code. You can drop the STL and you can have its built-in slicer do it, but it's Raspberry Pi and
yeah,
slow.
That's not going to be as good as a real computer for slicing something.
Correct.
Because like nowadays, like slicing just is pretty much instantaneous.
Yeah, yeah.
On a computer.
Hmm. So I just drop the G code directly onto the web server and just click print, and it handles everything. I can just shut it down. And I also have it set up to where I have a webcam hooked up to it. Mm-hmm. And so I can actually monitor, like, I'm like, oh, I need to go to the grocery store, but I can't leave my print unless I can monitor it while I'm at the grocery store.
Can you stop it if, like, an explosion happens or something?
Yeah, actually, I do have it set up to, I have a relay board on the Raspberry Pi that's in there. And so if it's on fire, I can click a button and it can shut down. Now,
nice.
I can't put out the fire yet, but at least power to it is gone.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I like it.
Hmm. But, I mean, but this still has like a Rambo control board or something, right?
Yeah, it's still got a control board in there and everything. It just talks to it over USB.
Right. I don't know. Well, here, let me look at the M2 price before we wrap up. Or I'm sorry, M3. Maker Gear M3. It is going to be $1 billion. Oh, I don't want to see a goddamn video. Oh, there's a dual extrusion. Okay, M3 single extrusion. Let's see. Oh, $2,550. That's quite a leap.
That's quite a bit. Especially since I paid $500 for my Monoprice, and I mean, I think it's quite a good printer.
Yeah, maybe I should just get a bunch of Monoprice printers. Although yeah, Chris was right. I mean, the Maker Gear is a really nice printer.
It is. It's just one of those. I know it's what you get. You get what you pay for, but for $500, you get a shit ton of stuff for the Monoprice one. I mean, it's got 24 volt everything. It's got, you know, a direct drive extruder. It's hard to beat this printer. And I did get an acrylic enclosure for it. And then I put in a all metal extruder in it so I can print polycarbonate.
Monoprice. I pretty much, it's not just for cables anymore.
No, they make a shit ton of stuff. Or they rebrand a lot of stuff.
They're going to be like the new Amazon.
Maybe.
Which one did you get? Oh, was it Maker Ultimate 3D printer?
Yeah.
Now it's $700.
Yeah, it's $700, and then they run a $200 off special every so often.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a code for it right now, so never mind. Oh, the Mini Delta 3D printer. Remember that thing?
Oh, yeah.
That was quite the thing. Actually, I buy all my filament from Monoprice.
I always buy... I can't even remember what brand it is. Oh, Polymaker. I always buy like PC Max.
Right.
I like printing in that polycarbonate because that's easier to sand and it's just holds its tolerances better. Since I print mostly like mechanical things that have to get hot.
Right. Yeah, I've really gotten into exotics like that, strangely enough. I have like carbon fiber and steel PLA from Virtual Foundry, which is a place just south of here, actually. But I want to get like a ruby nozzle so I can put whatever I want through my printer without worrying about it destroying the brass.
Oh, yeah. I just run... The polycarbonate seems to be fine with brass. But I mostly funny thing.
Oh yeah,
most
that would be. I'm talking about like if you do like carbon fiber or like you know steel. Metal infused. Yeah. I think steel's okay because the steel particles are spherical. But I guess like the brass is more like flakes, so it can go through at an angle and like tear up your nozzle.
Makes sense. The thing I print the most is actually just spacers for doing like soldering. So like if we have a customer that says, I need to solder a LED, like a through-hole LED, like 3 millimeters off the board. Well, that's kind of hard to do that.
Right, and so you just make a spacer for it.
Yeah, I just print these spacers that are like little U's that are 3 millimeters thick in this case. And they just slide under.
Remove it when you're done.
Yeah, and so that way we can like set them up with all the spacers and then put the boards into selective solder and then it just solders it.
Nice.
Yeah. And for those that don't know, a selective solder is like a motorized CNC machine, but instead of a router bit, it's got a fountain of molten tin.
And it's under the PCB.
And so it hits like a 5 millimeter dot with molten solder.
So it rises up and solders the bottom side of a PCB to solder together the through-hole components.
Yeah, so that's how we do most of our through-hole.
How do you do the flux for that? Do you spray it first?
Yeah, it's got a sprayer. It's got like an atomizer flux sprayer thingy that kind of works.
Do you have to clean it afterwards?
We should. We never do, though.
Well, those have been some great electronics topics for the podcast.
Yeah.
See, we can talk about things other than movies, right?
Yeah, because movies are going to fail, right? Movie theaters, that is.
I think movie theaters will, yeah. Maybe. All right, well, what did you think about Parker and I's project ideas? Are there any cool projects you'd like to see us make in the future? Are you sad that the Ben Heck Show is over? Let us know in the comments below.
If you have a humidity pressure sensor thingy, let me know too.
Oh yeah, a way to detect humidity in a high pressure environment for air compressors.
Yep.
Very cool. All right, well, hopefully we can get Jones back on next time and we'll see you later.
Later, everyone.